I am mentally honorable. Get Carlos. There was a second, ground-floor entrance to the general's home, to the right of the steps, beyond a gate, where deliveries were made to the downstairs kitchen. Villiers had agreed to leave the gate and the door unlatched. Bourne had not bothered to tell the old soldier that it did not matter, that he would get inside in any event, a degree of damage intrinsic to his strategy. But first, there was the risk that Villiers' house was being watched, there being good reasons for Carlos to do so, and equally good reasons not to do so. All things considered, the assassin might decide to stay as far away from Angelique Villiers as possible, taking no chance that one of his men could be picked up, thus proving his connection, the Parc Monceau connection. On the other hand, the dead Angelique was his cousin and lover, the only person on earth he cares about, Philippe d'Anjou. D'Anjou. Of course there'd be someone watching, or two, or ten. If d'Anjou had gotten out of France, Carlos could assume the worst. If the man from Medusa had not, the assassin would know the worst. The colonial would be broken, every word exchanged with Cain revealed. Where were Carlos' men? Strangely enough, thought Jason, if there was no one posted in Parc Monceau on this particular night, his entire strategy was worthless. It was not. They were there, in a sedan, the same sedan that had raced through the gates of the Louvre 12 hours ago, the same two men, killers who were the backups of killers. The car was 50 feet down the street on the left-hand side, with a clear view of Villiers' house. But were those two men slumped down in the seat, their eyes awake and alert, all that were there? Bourne could not tell. Automobiles lined the curbs on both sides of the street. He crouched in the shadows of the corner building, diagonally across from the two men in the stationary sedan. He knew what had to be done, but he was not sure how to do it. He needed a diversion, alarming enough to attract Carlos' soldiers, visible enough to flush out any others who might be concealed in the street or on a rooftop, or behind a darkened window. Fire. Out of nowhere. Sudden, away from Villiers' house, yet close enough and startling enough to send vibrations throughout the quiet, deserted, tree-lined street. Vibrations. Sirens. Explosive. Explosions. It could be done. It was merely a question of equipment. Bourne crept back behind the corner building into the intersecting street and ran silently to the nearest doorway, where he stopped and removed his jacket and topcoat. Then he took off his shirt, ripping the cloth from collar to waist. He put both coats on again, pulling up the lapels, buttoning the topcoat, the shirt under his arm. He peered into the night rain, scanning the automobiles in the street. He needed gasoline, but this was Paris, and most fuel tanks would be locked. Most, but not all. There had to be an unsecured top among the line of cars at the curb. And then he saw what he wanted to see directly up ahead on the pavement, chained to an iron gate. It was a motorbike. Larger than a street scooter, smaller than a cycle, its gas tank a metal bubble between handlebars and seat. The top would have a chain attached, but it was unlikely to have a lock. 8 liters of fuel was not 40. The risk of any theft had to be balanced against the proceeds, and 2 gallons of gas was hardly worth a 500-franc fine. Jason approached the bike. He looked up and down the street. There was no one. No sounds other than the quiet spattering of the rain. He put his hand on the gas tank top and turned it. It unscrewed easily. Better yet, the opening was relatively wide, the gas level nearly full. He replaced the top. He was not yet ready to douse his shirt. Another piece of equipment was needed. He found it at the next corner by a sewer drain. A partially dislodged cobblestone, forced from its recess by a decade of careless drivers jumping the curb. He pried it loose by kicking his heel into the slice that separated it from its jagged wall. He picked it up along with a smaller fragment and started back toward the motorbike, the fragment in his pocket, the large brick in his hand. He tested its weight, tested his arm. It would do. Both would do. 3 minutes later, he pulled the drenched shirt slowly out of the gas tank, the fumes mingling with the rain, the residue of oil covering his hands. He wrapped the cloth around the cobblestone, twisting and crisscrossing the sleeves, tying them firmly together, holding his missile in place. He was ready. He crept back to the edge of the building at the corner of Villiers Street. The two men in the sedan were still low in the front seat, their concentration still on Villiers' house. Behind the sedan were three other cars, a small Mercedes, a dark brown limousine, and a Bentley. Directly across from Jason, beyond the Bentley, was a white stone building, its windows outlined in black enamel. An inside hallway light spilled over to the casement bay windows on either side of the staircase. The left was obviously a dining room. He could see chairs and a long table in the additional light of a rococo sideboard mirror. The windows of that dining room, with their splendid view of the quaint, rich Parisian street, would do. Bourne reached into his pocket and pulled out the rock. It was barely 1/4 the size of the gas-drenched brick, but it would serve the purpose. He inched around the corner of the building, cocked his arm, and threw the stone as far as he could above and beyond the sedan. The crash echoed throughout the quiet street. It was followed by a series of cracks as the rock clattered across the hood of a car and dropped to the pavement. The two men in the sedan bolted up. The man next to the driver opened his door, his foot plunging down to the pavement, a gun in his hand. The driver lowered the window, then switched on the headlights. The beams shot forward, bouncing back in blinding reflection off the metal and the chrome of the automobile in front. It was a patently stupid act, serving only to point up the fear of the men stationed in Parc Monceau. Now. Jason raced across the street, his attention on the two men, whose hands were covering their eyes, trying to see through the glare of the reflected light. He reached the trunk of the Bentley, the cobblestone brick under his arm, a matchbook in his left hand, a cluster of torn-off matches in his right. He crouched, struck the matches, lowered the brick to the ground, then picked it up by an extended sleeve. He held the burning matches beneath the gas-soaked cloth. It burst instantly into flame. He rose quickly, swinging the brick by the sleeve, and dashed over the curb, hurling his missile toward the bulging framework of the casement window with all his strength, racing beyond the edge of the building as impact was made. The crash of shattering glass was a sudden intrusion on the rain-soaked stillness of the street. Bourne raced to his left across the narrow avenue, then back toward Villiers' block, again finding the shadows he needed. The fire spread, fanned by the wind from the broken window, leaping up into the willowy backing of the drapes. Within 30 seconds the room was a flaming oven, the fire magnified by the huge sideboard mirror. Shouts erupted, windows lighted up nearby, then farther down the street. A minute passed and the chaos grew. The door of the flaming house was yanked open and figures appeared. An elderly man in a nightshirt, a woman in a negligee and one slipper, both in panic. Other doors opened, other figures emerged, adjusting from sleep to chaos, some racing toward the fire-swept residence. A neighbor was in trouble. Jason ran diagonally across the intersection, one more running figure in the rapidly gathering crowd. He stopped where he had started only minutes before, by the edge of the corner building, and stood motionless, trying to spot Carlos' soldiers. He had been right. The two men were not the only guards posted in Parc Monceau. There were 4 men now, huddling by the sedan, talking rapidly, quietly. No, 5. Another walked swiftly up the pavement, joining the 4. He heard sirens, growing louder, drawing nearer. The 5 men were alarmed. Decisions had to be made. They could not all remain where they were. Perhaps there were arrest records to consider. Agreement. 1 man would stay, the 5th man. He nodded and walked rapidly across the street to Villiers' side. The others climbed into the sedan, and as a fire engine careened up the street, the sedan curved out of its parking place and sped past the red behemoth racing in the opposite direction. One obstacle remained. The fifth man. Jason rounded the building, spotting him halfway between the corner and Villiers' house. It was now a question of timing and shock. Bourne broke into a loping run, similar to that used by the people heading toward the fire, his head angled back toward the corner, running partially backward, a figure melting into the surrounding pattern, only the direction in conflict. He passed the man. He had not been noticed, but he would be noticed if he continued to the downstairs gate of Villiers' house and opened it. The man was glancing back and forth. Concerned, bewildered, perhaps frightened by the fact that now he was the only patrol in the street. He was standing in front of a low railing. Another gate, another downstairs entrance to another expensive house in Parc Monceau. Jason stopped, taking two rapid side steps toward the man, then pivoted, his balance on his left foot, his right lashing out at the fifth man's midsection, pummeling him backward over the iron rail. The man shouted as he fell down into the narrow concrete corridor. Bourne leaped over the railing, the knuckles of his right hand rigid, the heels of both feet pushed forward. He landed on the man's chest, the impact breaking the ribs beneath him, his knuckles smashing into the man's throat. Carlos' soldier went limp. He would regain consciousness long after someone removed him to a hospital. Jason searched the man. There was a single gun strapped to his chest. Bourne took it out and put it into his topcoat pocket. He would give it to Villiers. Villiers. The way was clear. He climbed the staircase to the third floor. Halfway up the steps, he could see a line of light at the bottom of the bedroom door. Beyond that door was an old man who was his only hope. If ever in his life, remembered and unremembered, he had to be convincing. It was now. And his conviction was real. There was no room for the chameleon now. Everything he believed was based on one fact. Carlos had to come after him. It was the truth. It was the trap. He reached the landing and turned to his left toward the bedroom door. He paused for a moment, trying to dismiss the echo in his chest. It was growing louder, the pounding more rapid. Part of the truth. Not all of it. No invention, simply omission. An agreement. A contract with a group of men. Honorable men who were after Carlos. That was all Villiers had to know. It was what he had to accept. He could not be told he was dealing with an amnesiac, for in that loss of memory might be found a man of dishonor. The legend of Saint-Cyr, Algeria and Normandy would not accept that. Not now, here, at the end of his life. Oh God, the balance was tenuous. The line between belief and disbelief so thin. As thin as it was for the man corpse whose name was not Jason Bourne. He opened the door and stepped inside, into an old man's private hell. Outside, beyond draped windows, the sirens raged and the crowds shouted. Spectators in an unseen arena, jeering the unknown, oblivious to its unfathomable cause. Jason closed the door and stood motionless. The large room was filled with shadows, the only light a bedside table lamp. His eyes greeted by a sight he wished he did not have to see. Villiers had dragged a high-backed desk chair across the room and was sitting on it at the foot of the bed, staring at the dead woman sprawled over the covers. Angelique Villiers' bronzed head was resting on the pillow, her eyes wide, bulging out of their sockets. Her throat was swollen, the flesh a reddish purple, the massive bruise having spread throughout her neck. Her body was still twisted, in contrast to the upright head. Contorted in furious struggle, her long bare legs stretched out, her hips turned, the negligee torn, her breasts bursting out of the silk. Even in death, sensual. There had been no attempt to conceal the whore. The old soldier sat like a bewildered child, punished for an insignificant act, the meaningful crime having escaped his tormentor's reasoning, and perhaps his own. He pulled his eyes away from the dead woman and looked at Bourne. "What happened outside?" he asked in a monotone. "Men were watching your house. Carlos' men. 5 of them. I started a fire up the block. No one was hurt. All but one man left. I took him out." "You're resourceful, Monsieur Bourne." "I'm resourceful," agreed Jason. "But they'll be back. The fire'll be out, and they'll come back. Before then, if Carlos puts it together, and I think he will. If he does, he'll send someone in here. He won't come himself, of course, but one of his guns will be here. When that man finds you, and her, he'll kill you. Carlos loses her, but he still wins. He wins a second time. He's used you through her, and at the end, he kills you. He walks away, and you're dead. People can draw whatever conclusions they like, but I don't think they'll be flattering." "You're very precise, assured of your judgment. I know what I'm talking about. I'd prefer not to say what I'm going to say, but there's no time for your feelings. I have none left. Say what you will. Your wife told you she was French, didn't she?"
"Yes,
from the south. Her family was from Louis-Barrousse, near the Spanish border. She came to Paris years ago, lived with an aunt. What of it? Did you ever meet her family?"
"No."
"They didn't come up for your marriage?" "All things considered, we thought it would be best not to ask them. The disparity of our ages would have disturbed them." "What about the aunt here in Paris?"
"She died before I met Angelique. What's the point of all this?"
"Your wife wasn't French. I doubt there was even an aunt in Paris, and her family didn't come from Louis-Barrousse, although the Spanish border has a certain relevance. It could cover a lot, explain a lot."
"What do you mean?"
"She was Venezuelan. Carlos' first cousin, his lover since she was 14. They were a team, have been for years. I was told she was the only person on earth he cared about. A whore. An assassin's instrument. I wonder how many targets she set up. How many valuable men are dead because of her. I cannot kill her twice. You can use her. Use her death."
"The insanity you spoke of?"
"The only insanity is if you throw your life away. Carlos wins it all. He goes on using his gun, and sticks of dynamite, and you're one more statistic. Another kill added to a long list of distinguished corpses. That's insane. And you're the reasonable man. You assume the guilt for a crime you did not commit, for the death of a whore, hunted for a killing that was not yours. That's part of it. The essential part, actually. Don't talk to me of insanity, young man. I beg you, leave. What you've told me gives me the courage to face Almighty God. If ever a death was justified, it was hers by my hand. I will look into the eyes of Christ and swear it." "You've written yourself out, then," said Jason, noticing for the first time the bulge of a weapon in the old man's jacket pocket. "I will not stand trial, if that's what you mean." "Oh, that's perfect, General. Carlos himself couldn't have come up with anything better. Not a wasted motion on his part. He doesn't even have to use his own gun. But those who count will know he did it. He caused it." "Those who count will know nothing. Une affaire de cœur. Une grave maladie. I am not concerned with the tongues of killers and thieves. And if I told the truth, told why you killed her, who would listen?
even should you live to speak. I'm not a fool, Monsieur Bourne. You are running from more than Carlos. You are hunted by many, not just one. You as much as told me so. You would not tell me your name. For my own safety, you claimed. When and if this was over, you said, it was I who might not care to be seen with you. Those are not the words of a man in whom much trust is placed. You trusted me. I told you why, said Villiers, glancing away, staring at his dead wife. It was in your eyes. The truth? The truth. Then look at me now. The truth is still there. On that road to Nanterre, you told me you'd listen to what I had to say because I gave you your life. I'm trying to give it to you again. You can walk away free, untouched. Go on standing for the things you say are important to you, were important to your son. You can win. Don't mistake me. I'm not being noble. Your staying alive and doing what I ask is the only way I can stay alive. The only way I'll ever be free. The old soldier looked up. Why? I told you I wanted Carlos because something was taken from me. Something very necessary to my life, my sanity. And he was the cause of it. That's the truth. I believe it's the truth. But it's not the whole truth. There are other people involved. Some decent, some not. And my agreement with them was to get Carlos. Trap Carlos. They want what you want. But something happened that I can't explain. I won't try to explain. And those people think I betrayed them. They think I made a pact with Carlos. That I stole millions from them and killed others who were my links to them. They have men everywhere, and the orders are to execute me on sight. You were right. I'm running from more than Carlos. I'm hunted by men I don't know and can't see, for all the wrong reasons. I didn't do the things they say I did, but no one wants to listen. I have no pact with Carlos. You know I don't. I believe you. There's nothing to prevent me from making a call on your behalf. I owe you that. How? What are you going to say? The man known to me as Jason Bourne has no pact with Carlos. I know this because he exposed Carlos' mistress to me, and that woman was my wife, the wife I choked to death so as not to bring dishonor to my name. I'm about to call the Sûreté and confess my crime, although of course I won't tell them why I killed her, or why I'm going to kill myself. Is that it, General? Is that what you're going to say? The old man stared silently at Bourne, the fundamental contradiction clear to him. I cannot help you then. Good. Fine. Carlos wins it all. She wins. You lose. Your son loses. Go on. Call the police. Then put the barrel of the gun in your goddamn mouth and blow your goddamn head off. Go on! That's what you want? Take yourself out. Lie down and die. You're not good for anything else anymore. You're a self-pitying old, old man. God knows you're no match for Carlos. No match for the man who placed 5 sticks of dynamite in Rue de Bac and killed your son. Villiers' hands shook. The trembling spread to his head. Do not do this. I'm telling you, do not do this. Telling me? You mean you're giving me an order? The little old man with the big brass buttons is issuing a command? Well, forget it. I don't take orders from men like you. You're frauds. You're worse than all the people you attack. At least they have the stomachs to do what they say they're going to do. You don't. All you've got is wind. Words and wind and self-serving bromides. Lie down and die, old man, but don't give me an order.
Villiers unclasped his hands and shot out of the chair, his racked body now trembling.
I told you. No more.
I'm not interested in what you tell me. I was right the first time I saw you. You belong to Carlos. You were his lackey alive, and you'll be his lackey dead. The old soldier's face grimaced in pain. He pulled out his gun, the gesture pathetic, the threat, however, real.
I've killed many men in my time. In my profession, it was unavoidable, often disturbing. I don't want to kill you now, but I will if you disregard my wishes. Leave me. Leave this house.
That's terrific. You must be wired into Carlos' head. You kill me, he sweeps the board. Jason took a step forward, aware of the fact that it was the first movement he had made since entering the room. He saw Villiers' eyes widen. The gun shook, its oscillating shadow cast against the wall. A single half ounce of pressure and the hammer would plunge forward, bullet finding its mark. For in spite of the madness of the moment, the hand that held that weapon had spent a lifetime gripping steel. It would be steady when the instant came. If it came. That was the risk Bourne had to take. Without Villiers, there was nothing. The old man had to understand. Jason suddenly shouted, "Go on! Fire! Kill me! Take your orders from Carlos! You're a soldier! You've got your orders! Carry them out!" The trembling in Villiers' hand increased, the knuckles white as the gun rose higher, its barrel now leveled at Bourne's head. And then Jason heard the whisper from an old man's throat.
Vous êtes un soldat. Arrêtez. Arrêtez.
What?
I am a soldier. Someone said that to me recently. Someone very dear to you.
Villiers spoke quietly.
She shamed an old warrior into remembering who he was, who he had been. On dit que vous êtes un géant. Je le crois. She had the grace, the kindness to say that to me also. She had been told I was a giant, and she believed it. She was wrong. Almighty God, she was wrong. But I shall try.
André Villiers lowered the gun. There was dignity in the submission. A soldier's dignity. A giant's. What would you have me do? Jason breathed again. Force Carlos into coming after me. But not here. Not in Paris. Not even in France.
Where then?
Jason held his place. Can you get me out of the country? I should tell you I'm wanted. My name and description by now are on every immigration desk and border check in Europe.
For the wrong reasons.
For the wrong reasons.
I believe you. There are ways. The conseiller militaire has ways and will do as I ask.
With an identity that's false? Without telling them why?
My word is enough. I've earned it.
Another question. That aide of yours you talked about. Do you trust him? Really trust him?
With my life. Above all men.
With another's life? One you correctly said was very dear to me?
Of course. Why? You'll travel alone.
I have to. She'd never let me go.
You'll have to tell her something.
I will. That I'm underground here in Paris, or Brussels, or Amsterdam. Cities where Carlos operates. But she has to get away. Our car was found in Montmartre. Carlos' men are searching every street, every flat, every hotel. You're working with me now. Your aide will take her into the country. She'll be safe there. I'll tell her that.
I must ask the question now. What happens? if you don't come back? Bourne tried to keep the plea out of his voice. I'll have time on the plane. I'll write out everything that's happened, everything that I remember. I'll send it to you, and you make the decisions. With her. She called you a giant. Make the right decisions. Protect her. Vous êtes un soldat. Arrêtez. You have my word. She'll not be harmed. That's all I can ask. Villiers threw the gun on the bed. It landed between the twisted bare legs of the dead woman. The old soldier coughed abruptly, contemptuously, his posture returning. To practicalities, my young wolf pack, he said, authority coming back to him awkwardly, but with definition. What's this strategy of yours? To begin with, you're in a state of collapse, beyond shock. You're an automaton walking around in the dark, following instructions you can't understand but have to obey. Not very different from reality, wouldn't you say? Interrupted Villiers. Before a young man with truth in his eyes forced me to listen to him? But how is this perceived state brought about? And why? All you know, all you remember, is that a man broke into your house during the fire and smashed his gun into your head. You fell unconscious. When you woke up, you found your wife dead, strangled, a note by her body. It's what's in the note that's driven you out of your mind. What would that be? Asked the old soldier cautiously. The truth, said Jason. The truth you can't ever permit anyone to know. What she was to Carlos. What he was to her. The killer who wrote the note left a telephone number, telling you that you could confirm what he's written. Once you were satisfied, you could destroy the note and report the murder any way you like. But for telling you the truth, for killing the whore who was so much a part of your son's death, he wants you to deliver a written message. To Carlos? No. He'll send a relay. Thank God for that. I'm not sure I could go through with it, knowing it was him. The message will reach him. What is it? I'll write it out for you. You can give it to the man he sends. It's got to be exact, both in what it says and what it doesn't say. Bourne looked over at the dead woman, at the swelling in her throat. Do you have any alcohol?
A drink?
No, rubbing alcohol. Perfume will do.
I'm sure there's rubbing alcohol in the medicine cabinet.
Would you mind getting it for me? Also a towel, please.
What are you going to do?
Put my hands where your hands were. Just in case, although I don't think anyone will question you. While I'm doing that, call whomever you have to call to get me out. The timing's important. I have to be on my way before you call Carlos Relay, long before you call the police. They'd have the airports watched.
I can delay until daybreak, I imagine. An old man's state of shock, as you put it. Not much longer than that. Where will you go?
New York. Can you do it? I have a passport identifying me as a man named George Washburn. It's a good job.
Making mine far easier. You'll have diplomatic status. Pre-clearance on both sides of the Atlantic.
As an Englishman? The passport's British.
As a NATO accommodation. Conseiller channels. You are part of an Anglo-American team engaged in military negotiations. We favor your swift return to the United States for further instructions. It's not unusual. Insufficient to get you rapidly past both immigration points.
Good. I've checked the schedules. There's a 7 a.m. flight, Air France to Kennedy.
You will be on it.
The old man paused. He had not finished. He took a step toward Jason.
Why New York? What makes you so certain Carlos will follow you to New York?
Two questions,
with different answers, said Bourne. I have to deliver him where he marked me for killing four men and a woman I didn't know. One of those men very close to me. Very much a part of me, I think.
I don't understand you.
I'm not sure I do either. There's no time. It'll all be in what I write down for you on the plane. I have to prove Carlos knew. A building in New York, where it all took place. They've got to understand. He knew about it. Trust me.
I do.
The second question, then. Why will he come after you? Jason looked again at the dead woman on the bed. Instinct, maybe. I've killed the one person on earth he cares about. If she were someone else and Carlos killed her, I'd follow him across the world until I found him. He may be more practical. I think that was your point to me. There's something else, replied Jason, taking his eyes away from Angelique Villiers. He has nothing to lose, everything to gain. No one knows what he looks like, but he knows me by sight. Still, he doesn't know my state of mind. He's cut me off, isolated me, turned me into someone I was never meant to be. Maybe he was too successful. Maybe I'm mad, insane. God knows killing her was insane. My threats are irrational. How much more irrational am I? An irrational man, an insane man, is a panicked man. He can be taken out. Is your threat irrational? Can you be taken out? I'm not sure. I only know I don't have a choice. He did not. At the end, it was as the beginning. Get Carlos. Trap Carlos. Cain is for Charlie, and Delta is for Cain. The man and the myth were finally one, images and reality fused. There was no other way. 10 minutes had passed since he had called Marie, lied to Marie, and heard the quiet acceptance in her voice, knowing it meant she needed time to think. She had not believed him, but she believed in him. She, too, had no choice. And he could not ease her pain. There had been no time. There was no time. Everything was in motion now. Villiers was downstairs calling an emergency number at France's Conseiller Militaire, arranging for a man with a false passport to fly out of Paris with diplomatic status. In less than 3 hours, a man would be over the Atlantic, approaching the anniversary of his own execution. It was the key. It was the trap. It was the last irrational act. Insanity, the order of that date. Bourne stood by the desk. He put down the pen and studied the words he had written on a dead woman's stationery. They were the words a broken, bewildered old man was to repeat over the telephone to an unknown relay who would demand the paper and give it to Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez. I killed your bitch whore, and I'll come back for you. There are 71 streets in the jungle. A jungle as dense as Tom Quan, but there was a path you missed, a vault in the cellars you did not know about. Just as you never knew about me on the day of my execution 11 years ago. One other man knew, and you killed him. It doesn't matter. In that vault are documents that will set me free. Did you think I'd become Cain without that final protection? Washington won't dare touch me. It seems right that on the date of Bourne's death, Cain picks up the papers that guarantee him a very long life. You marked Cain. Now I mark you. I'll come back, and you can join the whore. Delta. Jason dropped the note on the desk and walked over to the dead woman. The alcohol was dry, the swollen throat prepared. He bent down and spread his fingers, placing his hands where another's had been placed.
madness.
Chapter 34. Early light broke over the spires of the church in Levallois-Perret in northwest Paris, the March morning cold, the night rain replaced by mist. A few old women, returning to their flats from all-night cleaning shifts in the city proper, trudged in and out of the bronze doors, holding railings and prayer books, devotions about to begin or finished with, precious sleep to follow before the drudgery of surviving the daylight hours. Along with the old women were shabbily dressed men, most also old, others pathetically young, holding overcoats together, seeking the warmth of the church, these clutching bottles in their pockets, precious oblivion extended, another day to survive. One old man, however, did not float in the trance-like movements of the others. He was an old man in a hurry. There was reluctance, even fear, perhaps, in his lined, sallow face, but no hesitation in his progress up the steps and through the doors, past the flickering candles and down the far left aisle of the church. It was an odd hour for a worshipper to seek confession. Nevertheless, this old beggar went directly to the first booth, parted the curtain, and slipped inside.
"Angelus Domini, did you bring it?" the whisper demanded, the priestly silhouette behind the curtain trembling with rage. "Yes." He thrust it in my hand like a man in a stupor, weeping, telling me to get out. "He's burned Cain's note to him and says he'll deny everything if a single word he's ever mentioned." The old man shoved the pages of writing paper under the curtain.
"He used her stationery."
The assassin's whisper broke, a silhouetted hand brought to a silhouetted head, a muted cry of anguish now heard behind the curtain.
"I urge you to remember, Carlos," pleaded the beggar. "The messenger is not responsible for the news he bears. I could have refused to hear it, refused to bring it to you."
"How? Why?"
"Lavier. He followed her to Parc Monceau, then both of them to the church. I saw him in Neuilly-sur-Seine when I was your point. I told you that."
"I know. But why?
He could have used her in 100 different ways. Against me. Why this?" "It's in his note. He's gone mad. He was pushed too far, Carlos. It happens. I've seen it happen. A man on a double entry, his source controls taken out. He has no one to confirm his initial assignment. Both sides want his corpse. He's stretched to the point where he may not even know who he is any longer."
"He knows."
The whisper was drawn out in quiet fury.
"By signing the name Delta, he's telling me he knows. We both know where it comes from, where he comes from."
The beggar paused.
"If that's true, then he's still dangerous to you. He's right. Washington won't touch him. It may not want to acknowledge him, but it will call off its hangmen. It may even be forced to grant him a privilege or two in return for his silence."
"The papers he speaks of?" asked the assassin.
"Yes. In the old days, in Berlin, Prague, Vienna, they were called final payments. Born uses final protection, a minor variance. They were papers drawn up between a primary source control and the infiltrator to be used in the event a strategy collapsed, the primary killed, no other avenues open to the agent. It was not something you would have studied in Novgorod. The Soviets had no such accommodations. Soviet defectors, however, insisted upon them."
"They were incriminating then."
"They had to be, to some degree. Generally in the area of who was manipulated. Embarrassment is always to be avoided. Careers are destroyed by embarrassment.
But then, I don't have to tell you that. You've used the technique brilliantly. 71 streets in the jungle, said Carlos, reading from the paper in his hand, an ice-like calm imposed on his whisper. A jungle as dense as Tam Quan. This time, the execution will take place as scheduled. Jason Bourne will not leave this Tam Quan alive. By any other name, Cain will be dead, and Delta will die for what he's done. Angelique, you have my word.
The incantation stopped, the assassin's mind racing to the practical.
Did Villiers have any idea when Bourne left his house?
He didn't know. I told you, he was barely lucid, in as much a state of shock as with his telephone call.
It doesn't matter. The first flights to the United States began within the past hour. He'll be on one. I'll be in New York with him, and I won't miss this time. My knife will be waiting, its blade a razor. I'll peel his face away. The Americans will have their Cain without a face. Then they can give this Bourne, this Delta, whatever name they care to.
The blue-striped telephone rang on Alexander Conklin's desk. Its bell was quiet, the understated sound lending an eerie emphasis. The blue-striped telephone was Conklin's direct line to the computer rooms and databanks. There was no one in the office to take the call. The Central Intelligence executive suddenly rushed, limping through the door, unused to the cane provided him by G2, Shape, Brussels, last night when he had commandeered a military transport to Andrews Field, Maryland. He threw the cane angrily across the room as he lurched for the phone. His eyes were bloodshot from lack of sleep, his breath short. The man responsible for the dissolution of Treadstone was exhausted. He had been in scrambler communication with a dozen branches of clandestine operations, in Washington and overseas, trying to undo the insanity of the past 24 hours. He had spread every scrap of information he could cull from the files to every post in Europe, placed agents in the Paris, London, Amsterdam axis on alert. Bourne was alive and dangerous. He had tried to kill his DC control. He could be anywhere within 10 hours of Paris. All airports and train stations were to be covered, all underground networks activated. Find him. Kill him. Yes? Conklin braced himself against the desk and picked up the phone.
This is Computer Dock 12, said the male voice efficiently. We may have something. At least, State doesn't have any listing on it.
What, for Christ's sake?
The name you gave us 4 hours ago?
Washburn.
What about it?
A George P. Washburn was pre-cleared out of Paris and into New York on an Air France flight this morning. Washburn's a fairly common name. He could be just a businessman with connections, but it was flagged on the readout, and since the status was NATO diplomatic, we checked with State. They never heard of him. There's no one named Washburn involved with any ongoing NATO negotiations with the French government from any member nation.
Then how the hell was he pre-cleared? Who gave him the diplomatic?
We checked back through Paris. It wasn't easy. Apparently it was an accommodation of the Conseiller Militaire. They're a quiet bunch.
The Conseiller? Where do they get off clearing our people?
It doesn't have to be our people or their people. It can be anybody. Just a courtesy from the host country, and that was a French carrier. It's one way to get a decent seat on an overbooked plane.
Incidentally, Washburn's passport wasn't even U.S. It was British.
There's a doctor, an Englishman named Washburn.
It was him.
It was Delta, and Francis Concierge had cooperated with him.
But why New York?
What was in New York for him? And who placed so high in Paris would accommodate Delta?
What had he told them? Oh, Christ, how much had he told them?
When did the flight get in? Asked Conklin.
10:37 this morning, a little over an hour ago.
All right, said the man whose foot had been blown off in Medusa as he slid painfully around the desk into his seat.
You've delivered, and now I want this scratched from the reels. Delete it. Everything you gave me. Is that clear?
Understood, sir. Deleted, sir.
Conklin hung up.
New York.
New York?
Not Washington, but New York.
There was nothing in New York any longer. Delta knew that. If he was after someone in Treadstone, if he was after him, he would have taken a flight directly to Dulles.
What was in New York?
And why had Delta deliberately used the name Washburn? It was the same as telegraphing a strategy. He knew the name would be picked up sooner or later.
Later, after he was inside the gates.
Delta was telling whatever was left of Treadstone that he was dealing from strength. He was in a position to expose not only the Treadstone operation, but he could go God knows how much further. Whole networks he had used as Kane, listening posts and ersatz consulates that were no more than electronic espionage stations. Even the bloody specter of Medusa. His connection inside the Conseiller was his proof to Treadstone how high up he had traveled. His signal that if he could reach within so rarefied a group of strategists, nothing could stop him. God damn it, stop him from what? What was the point? He had the millions. He could have faded.
Conklin shook his head, remembering.
There had been a time when he would have let Delta fade. He had told him so 12 hours ago in a cemetery outside of Paris. A man could take only so much, and no one knew that better than Alexander Conklin, once among the finest covert field officers in the intelligence community. Only so much. The sanctimonious bromides about still being alive grew stale and bitter with time. It depended on what you were before, what you became with your deformity. Only so much. But Delta did not fade. He came back with insane statements, insane demands. Crazy tactics no experienced intelligence officer would even contemplate. For no matter how much explosive information he possessed, no matter how high he penetrated, no sane man walked back into a minefield surrounded by his enemies. And all the blackmail in the world could not bring you back. No sane man. No sane man. Conklin sat slowly forward in his chair.
I'm not Kane. He never was. I never was. I wasn't in New York. It was Carlos. Not me, Carlos. If what you're saying took place on 71st Street, it was him. He knows.
But Delta had been at the brownstone on 71st Street. Prince, third and index fingers, right hand. And the method of transport was now explained. Air France, Conseiller cover. Fact. Carlos could not have known.
Things come to me. Faces, streets, buildings. Images I can't place.
I know 1,000 facts about Carlos, but I don't know why.
Conklin closed his eyes.
There was a phrase. A simple code phrase that had been used at the beginning of Treadstone.
What was it?
It came from Medusa. Kane is for Charlie, and Delta is for Kane.
That was it.
Kane for Carlos. Delta, born, became the Kane that was the decoy for Carlos.
Conklin opened his eyes.
Jason Bourne was to replace Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez. That was the entire strategy of Treadstone 71.
It was the keystone to the whole structure of deception, the parallax that would draw Carlos out of position into their sights. Bourne. Jason Bourne. The totally unknown man, a name buried for over a decade, a piece of human debris left in a jungle. But he had existed. That, too, was part of the strategy. Conklin separated the folders on his desk until he found the one he was looking for. It had no title, only an initial and two numbers followed by a black X, signifying that it was the only folder containing the origins of Treadstone. T-71X. The birth of Treadstone 71. He opened it, almost afraid to see what he knew was there. Date of execution. Tom Quan Sector. March 25th. Conklin's eyes moved to the calendar on his desk. March 24th. Oh my God, he whispered, reaching for the telephone. Dr. Morris Panoff walked through the double doors of the psychiatric ward on the third floor of Bethesda's naval annex and approached the nurse's counter. He smiled at the uniformed aide shuffling index cards under the stern gaze of the head floor nurse standing beside her. Apparently, the young trainee had misplaced a patient's file, if not a patient, and her superior was not about to let it happen again. "Don't let Annie's whip fool you," said Panoff to the flustered girl. "Underneath those cold, inhuman eyes is a heart of sheer granite." Actually, she escaped from the fifth floor 2 weeks ago, but we're all afraid to tell anybody. The aide giggled. The nurse shook her head in exasperation. The phone rang on the desk behind the counter. "Will you get that, please, dear?" said Annie to the young girl. The aide nodded and retreated to the desk. The nurse turned to Panoff. "Dr. Moe, how am I ever going to get anything through their heads with you around?" "With love, dear Annie. With love. But don't lose your bicycle chains." "You're incorrigible. Tell me, how's your patient in 5A? I know you're worried about him."
"I'm still worried."
"I hear you stayed up all night."
"There was a 3 a.m. movie on television I wanted to see."
"Don't do it, Mo," said the matronly nurse. "You're too young to end up in there."
"And maybe too old to avoid it, Annie. But thanks."
Suddenly, Panoff and the nurse were aware that he was being paged, the wide-eyed trainee at the desk speaking into the microphone. "Dr. Panoff, please. Telephone for..."
"I'm Dr. Panoff," said the psychiatrist in a sotto voce whisper to the girl. "We don't want anyone to know. Annie Donovan here is really my mother from Poland. Who is it?"
The trainee stared at Panov's ID card on his white coat. She blinked and replied,
"A Mr. Alexander Conklin, sir."
"Oh?" Panoff was startled. Alex Conklin had been a patient on and off for 5 years, until they both had agreed he'd adjusted as well as he was ever going to adjust, which was not a hell of a lot. There were so many, and so little they can do for them. Whatever Conklin wanted had to be relatively serious for him to call Bethesda and not the office. "Where can I take this, Annie?" "Room 1, said the nurse, pointing across the hall. "It's empty. I'll have the call transferred." Panoff walked toward the door, an uneasy feeling spreading through him. "I need some very fast answers, Mo," said Conklin, his voice strained.
"I'm not very good at fast answers, Alex. Why not come in and see me this afternoon?"
"It's not me. It's someone else. Possibly."
"No games, please. I thought we'd gone beyond that."
"No games. This is a 4-0 emergency, and I need help."
4-0? Call in one of your staff men. I've never requested that kind of clearance."
"I can't. That's how tight it is."
"Then you'd better whisper to God."
"Mo, please. I only have to confirm possibilities. The rest I can put together myself. And I don't have 5 seconds to waste.
A man may be running around ready to blow away ghosts, anyone he thinks is a ghost. He's already killed very real, very important people, and I'm not sure he knows it. Help me. Help him.
If I can. Go ahead.
A man is placed in a highly volatile, maximum stress situation for a long period of time, the entire period in deep cover. The cover itself is a decoy, very visible, very negative, constant pressure applied to maintain that visibility. The purpose is to draw out a target similar to the decoy by convincing the target that the decoy is a threat, forcing the target into the open. Are you with me so far?
So far?
Said Panov. You say there's been constant pressure on the decoy to maintain a negative, highly visible profile. What's been his environment? As brutal as you can imagine. For how long a period of time? 3 years.
Good God, said the psychiatrist. No breaks?
None at all. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. 3 years. Someone not himself.
When will you damn fools learn? Even prisoners in the worst camps could be themselves, talk to others who were themselves.
Panov stopped, catching his own words and Conklin's meaning.
That's your point, isn't it?
I'm not sure, answered the intelligence officer. It's hazy. Confusing. Even contradictory. What I want to ask is this. Could such a man under these circumstances begin to believe he's the decoy, assume the characteristics, absorb the mocked dossier to the point where he believes it's him?
The answer to that's so obvious I'm surprised you ask it. Of course he could. Probably would. It's an unendurably prolonged performance that can't be sustained unless the belief becomes a part of his everyday reality. The actor never off the stage in a play that never ends, day after day, night after night.
The doctor stopped again, then continued carefully,
But that's not really your question, is it?
No, replied Conklin.
I go one step further. Beyond the decoy. I have to. It's the only thing that makes sense.
Wait a minute, interrupted Panov sharply. You'd better stop there, because I'm not confirming any blind diagnosis. Not for what you're leading up to. No way, Charlie. That's giving you a license I won't be responsible for, with or without a consultation fee.
No way, Charlie?
Why did you say that, Mo?
What do you mean, why did I say it? It's a phrase. I hear it all the time. Kids in dirty blue jeans on the corner. Hookers in my favorite saloons.
How do you know what I'm leading up to? Said the CIA man.
Because I had to read the books, and you're not very subtle. You're about to describe a classic case of paranoid schizophrenia with multiple personalities. It's not just your man assuming the role of the decoy, but the decoy himself transferring his identity to the one he's after. The target. That's what you're driving at, Alex. You're telling me your man is three people. Himself, decoy, and target.